So many of us have heard the old tale of three blind men walking together and they come across a strange object. Each one senses it and reaches out to discern what it is. One reaches out and feels a rough, immovable, flat surface and declares, we've hit a wall. Another reaches out and feels a thick, rough, circular object that goes all the way to the ground. He says, no, it's a tree. We must be at the edge of a forest. The third reaches out and feels a long object moving in his hands, and he could reach around it with his hands as it moved and wiggled. He said, no, it's a snake. What they couldn't tell is that they were all feeling an elephant, one feeling the side, one feeling a leg, and the other feeling a trunk. Many of us have likely experienced something similar, a time when, you know, we've experienced something, maybe a movie, an event, a person, and we've come away from that interaction with an impression, but the person beside us who just went through the same thing had a completely different impression. They understood it completely different. They responded completely differently. In our passage this morning, we're actually going to read through a couple of different stories. Jesus encounters two different people. In many ways, Jesus offers something similar to both people, but because of the people involved, there are two very different, even contrasting encounters. So we're starting in John chapter 4. We're picking it up in verse 43, or verse 46, sorry. We're going to start in verse 46. I'm not going to read all of the text to you this morning because we're going all the way down to chapter 5, verse 18. I'm going to tell you the story and encourage you, if you have a Bible, to follow along in it as I go. If you don't have a Bible, we have some Bibles on a table just out in the lobby. Some are large print for those of us who need that. Some are much smaller that you can carry them around in your pocket or your purse. You can help yourself to any of those that are there. And if you want to go grab one now, feel free to go ahead. But follow along as I kind of tell the story and jump in and read at certain parts. So the story starts in Cana, the northern part of Israel. Sometime before, we don't know exactly how long, Jesus had turned water into wine. We talked about that story a few weeks ago. There, Jesus is approached by someone described as a royal official who had a deathly sick son in Capernaum. Capernaum was about a day's journey away. Now, we read earlier that Jesus has been doing some signs. It's kind of a vague thing. He was doing other signs and wonders and didn't say what they were. But something of what he was doing had led this royal official to hear that, hey, maybe Jesus can help my son. Word had gotten to this royal official, and it seems he would have been used to having his bidding responded to. This royal official shows up and like, hey, if I make a request, I can expect someone to respond. He had some type of sway or cachet in the world. So he travels a day-long journey to find Jesus, and we read that he begged Jesus to come and heal his son who was close to death. At first, Jesus seems to balk at the request. And Jesus replies, unless you people see signs and wonders, you will never believe. It's almost like he's talking past this royal official. And the royal official's like, hey, this isn't about some like believing thing. My son needs help. He says again, sir, come down before my child dies. And Jesus replies, go, your son will live. The man, a day's journey away from where his son is, says, took Jesus at his word and departed. Despite being a full day away, despite Jesus never being near his son, the man believes and leaves. And while he's on his way back home, his servants, again, another sign that he's a man of wealth, that he's got these servants that are helping him, his servants come and they meet him announcing that his son is alive. His son has been healed. The story of this man, he's now no longer anywhere near Jesus. It concludes with these words. He says, when he inquired as to the time when his son got better, they said to him, yesterday at 1 PM, the fever left him. Then the father realized that this was the exact time at which Jesus had said to him, your son will live. So he and his whole household believed. It took curiosity, an effort for this man to check into, like, hey, when did this happen? And connect the dots that the healing happened at the exact same time that Jesus said his son would be well. And this man, who he was a successful man, he was a part of the elite, who had all that he needed except the power to heal his son. This man believed in Jesus. We turn the page or go to the next chapter. We find Jesus says sometime later. It kind of skips a bunch of time and it skips space because Jesus was up north. It says sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. He's in Jerusalem in a very different setting. He's there for a religious festival and he visits a place called Bethesda near one of Jerusalem's gates. It's described as having five covered colonnades, pillars holding up a roof, and a number of disabled people would lie there. Now, the earliest manuscripts we have don't tell us why they are there. They wouldn't have been welcomed in the temple because they're disabled and considered unclean. Perhaps they're there because it's covered from the heat. Maybe they're there because it's a place where people would come and go near the gates and they could beg. Whatever reason, Jesus walks among them and comes across a man who has been an invalid for 38 years. For almost four decades, he struggled beneath the weight of his infirmity and beneath the weight of the judgment that comes with being one who is infirmed in this world. See, most of the people around him believed that those who were sick or disabled got to be that way because of sin, whether it was theirs or somebody else's. We're going to pick that topic up next week. But that's what people believed. He lived his life under that judgment, as if the weight of being an invalid wasn't enough. He's also there. Well, it's obviously his fault. Makes us think about how we speak and think about people who are struggling in our world, eh? But Jesus doesn't approach him with judgment. Instead, Jesus approaches him, and it seems like Jesus is doing it kind of quietly. He says, do you want to get well? In verse 7, it says, sir, the invalid replied, I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, someone else goes down ahead of me. What is he talking about? What does he mean about people pushing down and getting in front of him? So if you look through, depending on which translation you have, it jumps. In the newer translations, most of them, it jumps from verse 3 to verse 5. And verse 4 is kind of in brackets. Some, if you have an older translation, will have something in verse 4. Basically, what's happened is when there's a verse that's in some manuscripts, the newest manuscripts, but it's not in the oldest, most reliable manuscripts, usually it's because the scribes who were handwriting out the Bible, which is what they did, like the Bible for centuries would just get handwritten out. And every once in a while, they come across something and the scribes would be talking and saying, like, this doesn't make sense. There's something here that's kind of confusing. And so sometimes scribes would kind of write in a common explanation of what happened. And so as we've gotten more and more translations or versions of the Bible, the older ones, which tend to be closer to the original, more reliable, they look and say, oh, wait, this wasn't in here back then. It got added somewhere later as an explanation. And so this is one of those situations. What you may have in verse 4 wasn't in the oldest manuscripts. It was something that got added as a possible explanation as to what was going on, because it's kind of confusing if verse 4's explanation isn't there. It seems like, what is this man talking about? Was a common question for people. And one ancient reason that was given, and those of you who have a verse 4 there, it explains that an angel would come, and when the waters moved, it was basically a race. First one in gets healed. If that's the case, if that's what was happening, this man seems to be saying, you know, of course I want to get well. That's why I'm here. I just can't because I'm an invalid, and every time I have the chance, somebody gets past me. For 38 years, I've lived this hopeless existence of being so close to healing, and yet so far. It's one plausible reading. It's good to note, though, that the meaning isn't obvious in the earliest original text. Another possibility is that this man can't even understand Jesus' question. Jesus asks, "Do you want to get well?" And the man is dumbfounded. He's laying there in a crowd of people who are crippled and blind and paralyzed. And he is so helpless that even among them, he can't even get into the water, perhaps to bathe, because people keep pushing past him. How can he imagine getting well if he can't even get clean? Either way, the point is that he is helpless. He's stuck. He can't get past his situation enough to even answer Jesus' question clearly. Do you want to get well? I feel like the obvious answer is just yes, but he's so stuck, he can't even say that. In the first story, we read about a man who approached Jesus himself with expectation, with a clear request. He knew who Jesus was. In this story, we read about a man with no expectation, no hope, no idea who he's talking to. And Jesus says to this man with no hope, "Get up, pick up your mat and walk." And in verse 9, we read, "At once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked." You would think this would cause quite a stir. This guy who couldn't walk for 38 years is now walking around again. And it does cause a stir, but not for the reasons we would expect. You see, this happened to be on the Sabbath. And good Jews weren't supposed to work on the Sabbath, and that included carrying things above a certain size, which would be like a mat. The Jewish leaders now see this guy walking around carrying a mat, and they call him out on it. "It's the Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat." They don't notice that this guy couldn't walk for 38 years. They just notice he's breaking the rules. And the man replies, "But the man who made me well said to pick up your mat and walk." And even now, no curiosity. "What do you mean made you well?" No, their curiosity is, "Who is this fellow who told you to do that? Who is this one causing disruption? You're carrying a mat. If other people see you carrying a mat, then they might start carrying mats. And next thing you know, we'll all be carrying mats around on the Sabbath." Oh. I love this next thing. Remember, the first story had a royal official who'd heard of Jesus, knew who Jesus was, came directly to Jesus with a request. And so when his son was healed, he knew who Jesus was and believed. Here, Jesus showed up to a man, offered him something he couldn't even imagine asking for. And now that he's healed, all the Jewish leaders want to know is who did it. And we read that the man who was healed had no idea who it was, for Jesus had slipped away into the crowd that was there. This guy had his life completely turned upside down in a good way, and he has no idea who was behind it, even though Jesus had been right there. We don't know exactly what this guy went and did, but we read in verse 14, "Later, Jesus found him at the temple and said to him, 'See, you are well again. Stop sinning or something worse may happen to you.' The man went away and told the Jewish leaders that it was Jesus who made him well." So Jesus meets him and invites him to live out of this place of healing and to be free from stuff. And all he can do is like, "Oh, I better go tell them who it was." Doesn't believe, doesn't follow. It seems like he's taking his healing for granted. He didn't come after Jesus. He didn't come to look for him or try to find out who it was that had healed him after 38 years. And once he did know, he didn't say thank you. Again, he didn't follow. He just goes to the Jewish leaders to tell them. And then here's what happens as a result. This is verses 16 to 18. "So because Jesus was doing these things on the Sabbath, the Jewish leaders began to persecute him. In his defense, Jesus said to them, 'My Father is always at his work to this very day, and I too am working.' For this reason, they tried all the more to kill him. Not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God." The Jewish leaders' main concern was they wanted Jesus to stop working, doing crazy, rebellious things like healing people on the Sabbath, because that was their understanding of what God's law demanded. And Jesus' defense, his explanation is, actually, God's always at work. And Jesus explains that he's just joining in what God is doing. He tells the Jewish leaders that the work he's doing is simply joining in the work of his Father. And that made them so angry, both that he would work on the Sabbath and that he would call his God his Father, that they wanted to kill Jesus. The Jewish leaders, their father was Abraham. That's what made them Jewish. And here, this guy Jesus is saying his father is God. Very quickly, just a few thoughts I want to consider in light of this passage. The first is rest in the fact that God doesn't take a day off. Jesus says, my Father is always at work to this very day, and I'm working too. So be bold enough to reach out to God. God's paying attention. God is active. God is not taking the day off. God is available to you. Be trusting enough to have hope, even when you can't see God's work. And when God shows up, have eyes to see and believe in God's work. You know, God is doing work. It doesn't mean that we're paying attention. It doesn't mean that we're going to accept it and receive it. You have both here. One who does and his life is transformed. The other one whose life is transformed and Jesus who? But in both situations, God was at work. God doesn't take a day off. Another thing to consider in light of this passage. You realize that everyone needs and experiences God's grace at work, whether they know it or not. Rich or poor, expectant or hopeless, believer or non-believer. There's a theological term called common grace. And basically that just says that God's grace is everywhere. The very fact that we have breath every day is a gift of God. The question is whether or not we're going to receive it or not. James wrote, every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. And we can get frustrated that, you know, people that don't believe us, like us, or look like us, or people we think are doing terrible things are still receiving what seems to be good gifts. That's because our God is a gracious God. Matthew 5, Jesus said, he causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and unrighteous. In a culture that centered around farming, and both sun and rain were good things. This isn't like he's giving good things to some and bad things to other. It's like, no, God is giving the things that are needed to live in this world to both, because God's grace is that big. And so we need to watch out for and give thanks for God's work wherever it is found. We all need and experience God's grace, whether we know it or not. So what can we do? Have our eyes open to pay attention to it and give thanks for it. A third thing that we can do is follow Jesus' example of joining in our Father's work in the world. That passage in Matthew 5 that I just read about sun and rain to both the righteous and unrighteous, the evil and the good. What follows that is, but I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. Because we worship a God who gives good things to everyone, we should be willing and join God in doing that too. One of the things that I struggle with not joining in, and it's heartbreaking when I think about it, is just how people talk about those, how people who claim to be Christians talk about those who disagree with them. This is not a left or right political thing. People that they think are doing something evil get demeaned and dehumanized on like across the board rather than following the example of Jesus. And following the example of God who is offering grace to all. We need to be following Jesus' example of paying attention to ways that God is working and look for ways to partner with what God is up to. Fourth thing I just want to mention in this, what happens to Jesus when he joins in what God is doing? Not a rhetorical question. Feel free to answer. He gets persecuted. They are out to kill him, actually. We shouldn't be shocked when we face troubles or persecution for following the example of Jesus. In Matthew 10, Jesus talking to his disciples, he says, well, when you're persecuted, not if, but when. In Matthew 5, the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, for in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you. The people who are following the heart of God throughout history have faced troubles and persecution. I do want to say, though, make sure it's for following Jesus, not for being a jerk. Sometimes it's not persecution either. Sometimes it's loss of privilege. You know, we've been able to do things as Christians in our world for a long time. Okay, I'm going to go off script a little bit. If churches lost tax exemption status, that doesn't mean we're getting persecuted. That means we've lost a privilege that we have had for a bunch of years. Right? Like there's loss of privilege can feel like persecution because we're losing something, but let's not confuse it with persecution. And people, Christians in other parts of the world who are getting killed because they're gathered for a prayer meeting, would look at some of what the North American church has labeled persecution and be dumbfounded. So we can expect to be persecuted for following Jesus. But let's make sure that we are acting in ways that align with the heart of God and loving in such a way that the persecution that we may face is actually because we're following Jesus, not because we're actually failing to follow Jesus well with love. But again, I just want to go back that whatever you're facing today, be encouraged and reminded that God is not taking today off. Whatever you face, God is not taking a day off. He is ready and available and listening. He is with you. Let's pray. God, thank you. Thank you that we can meet with you. Thank you that we can receive good gifts from you. Thank you that you never take a day off, that you are at work. God, help us to be people with our eyes open to that, with the courage to call out and ask, with eyes that are open to seeing you at work and to participate in what you're doing. God, give us strength and sustain us each day of this journey with you. In Jesus' name, amen.